We wake up every day and start with, what should people be seeing? And oftentimes it's not anything close to what, you know, the mainstream media is presenting.
They've been accused of having the most cynically concocted headlines on the internet. But this week here on Download This Show, we are sitting down with the editorial director of Upworthy to pull apart the ultimate clickbait headline.
Leaving a little curiosity for the reader.
Plus, it's a tiny USB dongle that attaches to your TV, and some say it's a better investment than a PlayStation and an Apple TV. We are reviewing the Google Chromecast. And why communicate with words when teeny tiny cartoon images will do it for you? We are dipping into the big wide world of emoji, because there's a whole bunch more coming. This is your weekly dose of technology, the internet and culture. My name is Mark Fennell, and welcome to Download This Show. And it is a big welcome to this week's panel. He is an app developer and tech commentator, Peter Marks. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mark.
And she's the news editor for CNET Australia, Claire Riley. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And don't forget, you can comment as well. If you happen to be watching this on YouTube, leave a comment down below. If you're listening on SoundCloud, you can leave a comment in the stream. And if you are listening in the radio, in the car, on the podcast, just send us a tweet using the hashtag DownloadThisShow. Now, first up, I want you to tell us, what do these musicians have in common? We could have had it
all. Well, I bet that you look good on the dance floor. I don't know if you're looking for romance.
All right, so we have Adele, the Arctic Monkeys, Vampire Weekend, and Jack White. What is it that those musicians, Claire Riley, have in common?
Look, I can say for certain that I don't think any of them have ever toured with Tom Jones. No, this is about something that YouTube is planning on bringing in, and I think they're going to have a few people kind of miffed with this one. They're planning on introducing a sort of a paid-for-subscription service. It'd be ad-free, a departure from the traditional YouTube model. But as part of the kind of new terms of service that they have for artists, There are some artists that aren't so happy, and some of their recording labels are saying, well, we're not going to sign these new terms of service. And YouTube said, great, fine for you. We're going to take your videos off YouTube. So you'll no longer be able to look up Adele or The White Stripes. You'll have a great deal of difficulty maybe finding some of the more independent artists, because the new terms of service for those artists are a little bit prohibitive and not really conducive to the way they want to be on YouTube.
See, this is an interesting thing. A lot of people don't realize that YouTube actually makes up one of the biggest chunks of this new category of streaming music. Now, I didn't realize that they were actually being classified as part of that until now. Did you realize that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's a new way of consuming music. So the thing that, when I was thinking about this, you know, Katy Perry and Lady Gaga, they released two singles, a single each, around about the same time. They were leaked on YouTube. There was a big storm. That was the way to view the film clips, which were sort of pretty rudimentary, but it was the way to hear the song if you hadn't heard it yet. So a lot of younger people especially are going, you know, I don't necessarily listen to traditional radio. I might stream music, but I still want to be in touch with new releases as they come out. So I'm going to listen to pop stars on YouTube, and I'll watch the film clips, and film clips become pieces of art. You know, you only have to see a 10-minute Lady Gaga film clip to recognize that. But I think it's a new way of consuming, and YouTube has sort of been providing this service a little bit for free, you know, out of the goodness of their own ad-filled hearts, but now they're monetizing it, and who can blame them? But I think it's...
Evidently, record labels can blame them.
Yeah, they can blame everyone. I think some of the record labels, some have signed up and said, fine, you know, it's a good way to get money for our artists, but others are not down with it. And I think the worrying thing for me with this is that it's potentially just going to create another homogenized music service where you won't be able to find, I mean, when Adele is cast as indie or, you know, a kind of a more obscure artist, what does that say about some of the weirder artists? And I sort of think, what about the small-time Aussie bands that are wanting to put their clips up? Are they still going to be able to do that? Are we just going to get really, really big labels and big pop stars on YouTube and you won't be able to find the weirder stuff?
In terms of the music streaming market, we have quite a few. We obviously have Spotify, RDO, and then, of course, there's the world of you know, Beats Music and iTunes. It's actually quite a crowded space. In terms of what YouTube could offer with this, Peter, what would it take, do you think, what would it take for YouTube to offer that would make you want to switch from one of the other pre-existing providers in the world of a subscription music service?
Well, I think after looking at the Apple purchase of Beats, there's got to be something there to do with curation and making the, you know, the ability to build a playlist that matches what you already like, but throw in a bit of interesting stuff that you may not have heard. So I think that intelligent curation and that playlist thing, I mean, YouTube has channels and it does build playlists, but it doesn't really seem to know much about particularly musical tastes. It shows other topics that are, you know, of interest to you. So I think they've got to turn it into something more. But I don't know, I think watching a music video and just listening to music, streaming music, are different things. And I really wonder if it's wise for YouTube to try and get into that. I know there's apps that just rip the music from YouTube and just use it, search for this artist, find me their hit song and play the music track. But that isn't always a way to get good quality audio.
Mm. What about you? What would it take for you to switch from, you know, Spotify or something like that over to a new YouTube music subscription service?
I think it'd have to be a really, really streamlined user experience. At the moment, when you go to YouTube, it is very much... So the free service is click on a link and then you're waiting for the ad that you're not really interested in, then you get the film clip. I think it is like you say, Peter, it's just such a visual medium. So am I going to be streaming music, listening to a whole playlist of a certain style? Or, you know, I think that curated content element is really important, and that's where Spotify has really won out. They can give you a playlist of like 50s rockabilly for your dinner party, or, you know, some lesser known Miles Davis tracks. You can build your own playlists. I think that YouTube would really have to get on that bandwagon. But, I mean, they're part of Google, so they probably know everything about my music tastes already.
I'm fascinated that neither of you two mentioned the one thing that separates YouTube from all of the other providers. Visuals. I mean, the notion of having a visual playlist at a party, surely that must appeal to people. If they can fold that in, wouldn't that be like something of a killer addition?
Like projected on the wall kind of thing. Yeah, yeah. I mean, almost like, you know, there've been those visualizers that just listen to the music and produce, you know, sparkling fireworks and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I wonder whether it's going to see people starting to monetize the actual and really focusing on the process of making film clips. I mean, that industry is already so huge. And as I said, there can be these little works of art. So why not, you know, stream them all, have them up displayed on the wall, you know, some really cool offbeat Radiohead film clips, or, you know, I think there's a cool opportunity there. Is it the way I would consume music? I don't think so. You know, but I'm not representative of my generation. I went out and bought a vinyl player the other day, so.
All right. What would it take for you to want to sign up to a YouTube subscription service? Let us know in the comment sections below if you happen to be watching on YouTube, or if you happen to be listening on SoundCloud, and of course, if you are listening to us in the car, you can let us know on Twitter. The hashtag is #DownloadThisShow. What would it take for you to want to sign up to a YouTube subscription service? Now, when we're talking about having it streamed up to a television, the perfect device for that would be what we're talking about next, which is the Google Chromecast. Now, to give this some context, we at this stage have 1,001 options for boxes you can connect up to your television. You've got your Apple TV, you've got PlayStation, Xboxes, and a lot of what they do has now been replicated in this tiny dongle. You plug it into your television, and then it does what?
Well, it just lets you send video from a phone or a tablet onto the TV. So in fact, it doesn't do very much at all. It's just a receiver for the video that you're already able to play on your phone. So it's, I guess the benefit of it is it's more cross-platform than Apple TV. So for households that aren't in the Apple ecosystem, then it does work with Android, it will work with iOS, it'll even work with Chrome, the browser, just running on your PC, and you can actually cast a tab. So it's very much a dumb device in that sense. It just sits there and receives. They're relatively cheap, $49 in Australia, around $50, compared to an Apple TV at $100 or thereabouts. Mm. Although Apple, I think, is just cutting the price just this week in Europe anyway, and I guess that will... come through. But yeah, I mean, I guess if you have a phone or you have a tablet with you, then it's great and you use that as the remote control. But if you want to use something on your own, I quite like being able to sit down just with a little Apple TV remote control and just, you know, rent a movie and not have to worry about anything except play pause.
See, it's funny that you say it's dumb. I would say dumb, but extremely flexible. Like one of the issues I've always found with Apple TV, and I quite like Apple TV, is that interaction between, and it's better than most things out on the market, but it's that interaction between typing, search, something going into it and having it find a YouTube clip. Obviously, where Apple is very successful is they've got that movie, that access to the iTunes movie store is right there, and that's really effective. But what struck me about Chromecast is that anything you can do in your browser, you can now do on your television, which doesn't sound like that much. But one of the areas where it becomes incredibly useful is something like YouTube, because what it actually does is it automatically looks for the highest resolution version of that YouTube clip. And rather than it streaming through your laptop or your phone up to the Chromecast, it has its own Wi-Fi network pickup and it starts streaming it straight to the Chromecast. So it's actually very, very smart. And one of the things somebody pointed out to me online when we were talking about doing it on the show was that if you're somebody that happens to stream TV shows a lot, it's enormously, enormously effective. They were saying the lag time's still not great, but it's a far easier way of replicating that television experience on your screen without having to, you know, download an AVI or an MP4 or something like that. It's a really effective way of doing it.
Apple TV does the same thing. Sorry, you know, if you're sending a program which is being streamed with HTTP live streaming, then what happens is your phone actually just passes that URL across to the Apple TV and it takes over the streaming. So you can actually turn your phone off and it will keep going. In fact, both of them have the same thing. They can stream, they can mirror, which is not a great way to do it because you only get the resolution of your phone up on the TV, or they can take over the stream. So, yeah, I think that most of the modern devices do that.
I think there's a cool opportunity here where, you know, there are some similarities with Apple TV. The Chromecast, you know, you've got a much more open ecosystem. But I think if anyone's ever tried to, you know, look up a YouTube video using their TV remote and they're trying to type in ladder goat using the arrow across, it's cumbersome. Oh, life problems. But
I guess you can do it with your iPhone. You can type it in.
Yeah, you can. But this is much more streamlined. And if you want to, anything that you can have in a Chrome tab in your Chrome browser, you can cast up to the TV. So that opens it up, and that means that, yeah, for people who are streaming TV, it's definitely kind to the people who are doing a little bit of shonky stuff with their media. Apple's ecosystem is very closed down. You buy your movies and TV shows through iTunes. But the ability to actually sit in front of your laptop instead of trying to navigate through the smart TV, and I think it opens up, we're seeing, it's just the start of Chromecast. I mean, Apple TV's been around since about 2007, I think. Mm. It's been through a number of iterations. So I think there's a real potential here with what could come, you know, more apps rolling out onto it, the ability to do more with it, and it's much more streamlined than having to clunk around with your smart TV. So I think there's a lot of potential with it. I'm not sure it's quite there yet, but it's only just come out in Australia.
You are listening to Download This Show, your guide to the week in technology, the internet and culture. Still to come, we have the editor of Upworthy, and great news now for people that prefer communicating in pictures rather than words. We are about to get 250 more emoji characters. Now, emoji are those tiny hieroglyphs you can put in text messages, and the Unicode Consortium have announced that we're getting more. Claire, the Unicode Consortium, they sound like a villainous sci-fi corporation. Please
up
tell me they
the
are.
On the top of Unicode Mountain.
On Unicode Mountain, with being guarded by a dragon.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, who exactly are they?
Okay, so basically, when you're writing out a letter, you're writing out a letter with a pen, but there is a standard that dictates how script and text, whether it's Roman or otherwise, how it's coded and how it appears digitally. So the Unicode Consortium, they
sound better
there
if you say it with a robe and maybe a pointy hat.
Oh, well, that's the uniform of the Unicode Consortium. Yeah. They are basically a not-for-profit group, and they control how Unicode is sort of rolled out, and they have a whole bunch of members who are sort of digital groups like Apple, like Google. Interestingly, it's not just new emojis, but it's also going to be things like, I think there's a symbol for Russian currency that is now going to be part of the new Unicode 7.0 that's coming out. So while there are some fab emojis that are going to come, there are sort of more practical and reasonable things it'll be.
So one of the things that I was surprised by, because I this is very new to me, the world of emoji, because I'm not a teenage girl, is that Unicode kind of... unicorn? No. Unicode, they say, we're introducing these new categories, and then it's up to other people to design the actual graphics that go with it, which is why particular emoji look different if you're on a Samsung phone to if you're on an iPhone. Of the different announced emojis, though, what was the one that struck you as the one you're most looking forward to?
Well, one of the new ones is a Vulcan hand salute.
Yeah, I can everyone do it? Claire, can you do it?
I believe it's actually called raised hand with part between middle and ring fingers.
And that's the thing. They just call it Vulcan salute. Would they have to pay, you know, royalties to Paramount Pictures?
They do all have names, and if you turn VoiceOver on, or you know, one of the accessibility screen readers on, they read each of the emojis. So they will say pile off poo or whatever the emoji is that you put into your email,
or levitating businessman in suit.
What is okay? That's the one where I was like, what were they smoking? Why does that need to exist? Why in any universe would you need levitating businessman?
Well, a lot of them, of course, date back to Japan, and it was the NTT Docomo's iMode phones, which are a very early data phone. And in 1998, they actually had the original emoji set. And at the time, they were 172 12 by 12 pixel images, just very tiny images. And I guess the reason why they were needed was that, you know, you couldn't send much data. So this was a way of expressing particularly emotions through a single character. It's actually a double byte character. And so they were actually included in Unicode, the global character set, at the behest of Google and Apple. I think this was a big step forward to go to a system that could cope with it. And then why not chuck a whole bunch of images in?
And I think people are gravitating towards them because exactly that, you know, a text, we've simplified language so much that we're just texting so quickly now that, you know, a picture tells at least 1,000 words.
200 by 200 pixels. Yeah.
I probably don't, I mean, I love them. They have changed my world. And if that indicates that I'm a teenage girl, well, at least I, you know, didn't drop ICQ into the conversation. So, but I
what better way was there to break up with somebody in 1998?
Yeah,
I ask
so
you.
True. I think it's such a fun way. I only use them ironically. So I pretty much end most of my text messages now with the squid icon, my favorite of the emojis.
What does that mean?
If you're not punctuating with a squid, then you're missing out on life. But it doesn't have to mean anything. I mean, instead of sending a message saying, hey...
Would a squid mean anything? That's right.
Oh, it's obviously a reference to soccer, World Cup soccer. Oh, no, I'm with you now. Yeah, I understand.
No, it's a reference to Hydra from the Marvel Universe.
It doesn't have to be a reference to anything. But speaking of comic books, instead of sending a message saying, hey, want to see Godzilla on Friday, I just spelt out the entire plot of Godzilla in emojis, you know, dinosaur, explosion, wave, sushi, happy cloud ending... Friday. And, you know, I think there's a great potential for comedy and ridiculousness. Or, you know, you can just use them for trying to chat to 15-year-old boys. I don't know, if you're a teenage girl.
You are listening to or watching the nerdiest thing produced by the ABC. I think we just took the mantle from Good Game on ABC 2. And finally, here on Download This Show, I'm going to read you some headlines. Headlines like, this kid just died and what he left behind was one-tacular. Dustin Hoffman breaks down crying, explaining something that every woman sadly already has experienced. Boy makes anti-Muslim comments in front of an American soldier. The soldier's reply, priceless. They are just a few of the highly clickable headlines produced by Upworthy, one of the most popular and some would say parodiable website in the world. But they're not just there to get clicks, they argue. They are an unapologetically progressive website and they are on a mission, they say, for good.
We wake up every day and start with what should people be seeing? And oftentimes it's not anything close to what, you know, the mainstream media is presenting or the breaking news of the day. Like when you're talking about a sustained conversation over a period of lots of years about climate change and what we're really going to do about it, you get a product that looks very, very different from mainstream media. You know, that's why 50 million unique visitors are coming to our site, is people are hungry for a sustained, substantial conversation about these issues, and not necessarily the newest thing going on that day. I'm Sarah Critchfield. I'm the editorial director of Upworthy.com. In a previous life, I was a lobbyist for a nonprofit in Washington, D.C., and I was working on poverty issues. And the most shocking thing to me during that time was when we would go into an office and we would say, you know, here is our issue and here is the bill, and can the senator please sign on? And oftentimes we would hear back, you know, we haven't heard from our constituents. We haven't heard from the people in our districts about this issue, and we don't think they care. However, if you could get, you know, I don't know, 4 to 6 people to call in about the issue, we'd be happy to sign the bill. And that got me to thinking a lot, gosh, 46 people, that's 4, 2, 6, you know, 4, 5, or 6 people, that's such a small number. So my first question kind of coming into Upworthy is, if more people were thinking about important matters, speaking about important matters, kind of raising more voice about them, how much easier would it be, you know, in D.C. to get really important legislation passed that actually moves topics like income inequality or climate change?
Okay, now, the front page of Upworthy, or at least the first point of influence that most people have with Upworthy is, of course, those really catchy headlines. Tell me, what's the breakdown? What makes a really great Upworthy headline?
We actually don't have a formula. The formulaic Upworthy headline has actually come to be because we've been parodied so much and because we've been copied so much. And so what happens is these copycat sites, and now there's dozens of them at this point, will look at one headline that we have written and take that one headline and formulize it across their site. And so this perception that Upworthy has a formulaic headline style, I think has really happened because of the copycat sites. At Upworthy, we test our headlines, and so we go with the headline that works. That's it. That's the rule. You go with the one that works. And so that's actually, you know, comes in a lot of different formats and a lot of different shapes and sizes. Our headlines, this do all have in common something called the curiosity gap, and so we like to pay attention to what makes people want to click in and know more. But that doesn't necessarily come by withholding information. So we have curiosity gap headlines that are also very descriptive and will say very plainly what the content is about, but still leads you to be curious to click. So if I would say there's anything, I would say leaving a little curiosity for the reader and drawing the user's interest in.
Not that long ago, there was a plugin that was released called Downworthy, which would essentially rewrite headlines of your site and other sites as well. I'm curious, what was the reaction internally at Upworthy to the existence of Downworthy?
You know, I actually didn't even look very closely at it. Again, like I said, there's been so many copycats and so much criticism. We actually will look at critical articles, and if we feel that they have substance, like that their critiques are actually thoughtful, we'll engage. And if not, we usually just ignore them. I find that there's people who just, you know, our style and our headlines just sort of rub them the wrong way, and that's okay. Not everybody has to like us, but, you know, like I said, what we really focus on, laser focus, is fact-checking and accuracy are things we pay attention to very, very seriously, and so if somebody's calling that out, we'll really listen. And then we pay attention to our audience. I mean, that's we get feedback by how many attention minutes they're spending with our content. And when that dips below a certain level, we adjust what we're doing. And when it stays high, we know the audience is happy and they like the product, and then we're happy with that.
I'm curious, what does success look like to you? In a year's time, what would you like to see Upworthy doing?
It's an interesting question because, drawing attention to things that matter doesn't necessarily have a linear path to concrete success. So if you look at something like the marriage equality movement and having everybody have equal access to the right to marriage, you can't necessarily go back and measure, like, you can't really pinpoint, like, what was the thing that started shifting public opinion on this issue? You know, was it, you know, that this article? Was it this Supreme Court case? Was it, you know, this organization's media work on it? Was it this video? It's very, very difficult. But what we have seen is a gradual shift over a series of years through a variety of methods that has helped shift public opinion and given citizens broader access to human rights. And so for me, always, it is just a my hope is always just that Upworthy would be just one piece of that puzzle, that we would be able to just play a part of this gradual shift that does just make the world a better place for people. But we don't necessarily have pinpoints. we don't have one idea of what that looks like. It really depends on the topic, and it really depends on the piece of content.
Sarah Critchfield there from Upworthy. How is it that Upworthy has become so powerful in terms of the shareability of content on the internet?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. I mean, it's only 2 years old, the website, and I think it's really speaking to the way a lot of people are consuming media these days. I mean, we talked about YouTube, we're talking about emojis, all of these things are snack-sized, but ultimately very sort of... they're fripperies, you know. It's the popcorn in some ways, the popcorn of media consumption and news stories. I think I have clicked and, you know, I can say so many people would have fallen in and just gone, oh, I'm tempted, I'll click through and I'm going to see what this is about. I think ultimately the stories are sort of heartwarming and nice, and that's why they are so shareable. But they talk about this idea of the, what is it?
The curiosity gap.
Yeah. So you are told just enough in the headline to think, oh, okay, I kind of have an idea to frame what this story will be about, but I really want to know what the actual tagline is, or what the punchline is, or what the big surprise is behind that click wall. So The Onion has now created a website called Clickhole. If you haven't seen this, you have got to see it, because it is just it's a parody of Upworthy and BuzzFeed and all those things, you know. One of my favorites was, this video may seem strange, but it actually has a really good point. And you click on it, and it is a cartoon dinosaur dancing in front of a swirling background with text at the front saying, racism is bad. And it's the point exactly, you know. It's all just this stuff designed to lure you in, and they have nailed the parody as only The Onion can.
But I fear for journalism. I just think we're in a bad place right now, and hopefully we'll grow up and grow out of this, because as you say, people actually want to read a more detailed analysis, and we need to value that, and we need to find a revenue model that works, because just numbers, you know, millions of clicks on a story at the moment means money, and what we want is really attention, and yes, there was detail in there that I valued more. Maybe we need donation buttons
or something. And someone spent time working on it, and they checked with their sources, and they actually worked on a story that wasn't just like, I've got to get this up in 7 minutes, so what's the most emotive, what's the most kind of exploitative headline that I can get up? And we'll probably still click occasionally, but I think we'll return to
it. I think we'll all wake up in the morning with a bit of a hangover, and we'll say, now, what's going on in the world? I really don't know.
Yeah.
I love this show. We went from Adele to a pile of poo emoticon to the importance of journalism, only on Download This Show. We have run out of time. Very big thank you to Peter Marks, app developer and tech commentator. Much appreciated.
Very postmodern. Thanks, Mark.
And the news editor of CNET Australia, Claire Riley. Thanks for being back.
Oh, it was great to be here and discuss Squid.
And as always, thank you for listening to another episode of Download This Show.